calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, love. Of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the studios of Seattle's Talk 1090 and WKTP. Very glad to be here with you. And last night, Congressman Jim McDermott and Bill Clinton, and I was emceeing the gig, and first time I've actually met Bill Clinton. I got to say, this guy, as you know, some of his politics, particularly his trade, his ideas on trade, I strongly disagree with, but a lot of other things. I think he's done a great job, but I don't know how to describe it. If you've never seen the guy speak in public, he has this charisma about him, this ability to connect with people that is absolutely, I have rarely seen it, probably not more than four or five times in my life, and I'm very impressed. And he gave a barn burner of a speech in which he, for example, criticized people who are dragging out flag burning. And I'm sitting there going, wait a minute, your wife just co-sponsored the constitutional amendment on that. I don't know. It was a great talk. It was a great presentation. And he came right out and said what I think is the really important point, which is the primary difference in the worldview of the classic American liberals from George Washington and Thomas Jefferson to today, which is that all the power should reside with the people, and that the largest number of people possible should be participating in governance, and government should be working for them, versus the classic conservative worldview as articulated by Sir Edmund Burke back in the late 1700s, Russell Kirk in his book The Conservative Mind, 1953. I mean, Clinton wasn't quoting these things, but which is that the power of a country is in its wealthy elite and its most powerful institutions, whereas the classic liberal worldview has been that the power of a country resides in its people and in the quality of the life of its people. So it's interesting. Stepping off from that, Andrew J. Colson is with us. He's with the Cato Institute. Cato.org is the website. And interesting and thought-provoking piece here on national school vouchers. Andrew Colson, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me, Tom.
Glad to have you here with us. There's a piece over on Cato.org in which, if I read this right, you are suggesting essentially that the Bush administration's proposal to toss out $100 million in school vouchers for low-income students is a bad idea. But you're suggesting that it's a bad idea principally because it's a federal program, not because you're opposed to school vouchers. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. The motivation behind the president's policy is excellent. He's trying to provide low-income families with more educational choice, more freedom over what their children are taught and where they go to school. That's a wonderful
thing. You don't
really
believe that.
But the problem is, if you centralize this kind of school voucher program at the federal level, you remove any kind of checks against regulatory encroachment on the use of those vouchers over time. So if people start deciding, well, I don't want to fund this kind of voucher school, and I don't want to fund that kind of voucher school, you add that up across a nation of several hundred million people, and you end up regulating almost every kind of school out of existence.
But just going back, maybe you didn't hear me when I interrupted you and I said you don't really believe that. You were saying that the reason that Bush is doing this is because he wants to help low-income students. The reason he's doing this is he wants to destroy public education. He wants to bust the unions. I mean, that's the main part of the agenda, is to break down public schools to the point where they can point the finger at the unions and say, okay, that's it, no more teachers' unions, and promote and transfer as much money as possible into private schools, particularly in Bush's case, religious private schools.
I personally like to avoid soul gazing. When the president said that he looked into Vladimir Putin's soul and saw a certain thing or didn't see a certain thing, I just thought that was a bad idea.
Doing soul gazing. I'm looking at what he has done. For example, the Congress refused to pass legislation that said that the government could give money to religious organizations to conduct what you might call welfare programs. Mm-hmm. James Madison's first veto as president back in 1812, his first veto as president was to veto a bill that gave money to a church in Washington, D.C. to care for the poor. He said if the federal government is going to pay for caring for the poor, which in his mind was a good thing and had been done ever since George Washington, then it should not be done through a church, because he was concerned that giving money to churches would corrupt the churches. That was his fear. And he was very explicit about it and laid it right out. And that's more or less been the policy of the government for years and years and years. Bush couldn't get the legislation through, so instead he, by fiat, creates this executive department of faith-based initiatives. And in an election year, 2004, hands out $1,000 million to churches for so-called faith-based initiatives. I mean, I'm just looking at what the guy's done, not...
Well, it's actually very interesting that you raise that point, because another of the reasons why I am somewhat hesitant about vouchers, and particularly about vouchers at the federal level, is that in order to provide universal access for the parents making choices of schools, you have to let them choose any school they want. You know, if you really want the system to work as well as possible, well, that means that parents may be able to choose ultra-conservative religious schools or extremely progressive liberal schools, and that means that every single taxpayer is obliged to pay for every single different kind of schooling. Well, this can cause problems. There are certainly taxpayers who might not want to fund a school that, say, expels students for being gay. I can imagine a lot of your listeners would be appalled by that prospect. There are probably a lot of taxpayers who wouldn't want to fund ultra-conservative religious schools or very progressive schools.
Well, the simple solution to this, Andrew, has been up till this point, Andrew Colson with Cato.org, has been that we pay for public education, mm-hmm. and if you don't want your kids to go to a public school, dig into your own pocket.
Yeah, and yet...
What's wrong with that?
Well, basically...
I mean, it's worked just fine for 100 years.
Well, I would have to disagree with that. I don't think it's working fine. I think when you have nearly a quarter of the American 16 to 25-year-old public not actually literate, according to the International Adult Literacy Survey, scoring basically at the very lowest or below the lowest level on that International Adult Literacy Survey in the late 90s, I don't think the system is working that well.
I would suggest, though, that if you drill down into those statistics, Andrew, maybe you can enlighten me on this, but from what I've seen, you drill down into those statistics, and first of all, you see that there are a lot of what some refer to as illegal aliens contaminating those statistics, shall we say.
Yeah, this being my business, have run the numbers in umpteen different ways, and even if you cream off the 5 or 10% best students in the United States, and you compare those to the 5 or 10% of best students in other countries, do this at the end of high school, the end of the K-12 education process, and you find that in math and science, we're at the bottom of the countries for which data is available.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with that broadly, but then the second point that I was going to make is if you go back and you look at our education versus other countries in the world in the 1950s, in the 1960s, in the 1970s, we were doing quite well. What happened starting in 1980 when Ronald Reagan came into office? I mean, he declared war against working people in the United States. He declared war against the middle class. And he essentially declared war against public education. Came right out and said, you know, the government should not be in the business of public education. And what we're seeing now, 25, 26 years later, is the consequence of a conservative war against public education.
Well, I think...
Which you guys have been cheerleaders for, by the way.
I haven't been around that long, but...
No, I mean Cato Institute. I mean, the whole libertarian worldview is, hey, the government should not have any business, you know, involving itself in things like education. That's socialism.
Yeah, well, basically my position at the Cato Institute is that the government can make it easier for people to obtain the kind of schooling they want for their kids without actually running schools itself. I argue for a system of education tax credits where parents, middle-income parents, can write off some of the cost of their own children's education directly, and that low-income families can benefit from private scholarship funds, which would also be funded through tax-credited donations. So for
private, in other words, let's look to the rich to take care of the poor here and hope that their generosity is better than Scrooge and Marley.
Well, that's actually the way the system works now.
The way the system works now is if you're poor, you can send your kids to public school for free.
Which are funded by businesses and wealthier taxpayers. The system's identical.
No, they're funded by all of us. And in fact, middle class taxpayers in the United States pay the largest load of it.
Well, in fact, the system that I'm advocating is basically the same kind of system with just more voluntarism involved. you get to choose as a taxpayer whether your money goes into the traditional public school system or goes into a scholarship fund. If you think
so what do people who don't have kids choose?
Pardon me?
So somebody who doesn't have children, what do they choose? They say no.
They would be able to choose either to do what they do now, which is just pay their taxes regularly. Those would go into the public school system. Or they could make a donation to a private scholarship fund. If there's a lot
voluntarily.
Yes, voluntarily.
So in other words, they could say to the public schools, screw you guys.
Well, not at all, because the scholarships would then go to low-income families.
It's but the scholarships are voluntary.
I'm sorry?
The scholarships are voluntary.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't get it. But people want to learn more about it, go over to Cato Institute. Cato.org is the website. Andrew Coulson, the author of the piece. Andrew, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure having you.
Good talking with you. It's 13 minutes past the hour. 13 coming up on 14 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom, if this clock is right. It may not be. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Oh, but ain't that America for you and me? Ain't that America something to see, baby? Ain't that America home on the free, yeah? Little big houses for you and me.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. This whole issue is just of vouchers in schools and things really goes back to this fundamental thing that as I started out the program talking about, Bill Clinton was talking about last night in Seattle. And frankly, I have to say, I was really impressed to hear a Democratic politician just coming out and saying, talking about the big picture stuff. And you know, just saying the bottom line here is that these ideologues in the Republican Party, these ideologues in the Republican Party absolutely believe that the strength and power and goodness of a nation resides in its most powerful institutions and its most wealthy individuals. And so it makes perfect sense that think tanks and those who represent that worldview would say, well, you know, we should do school vouchers or set up a program where the wealthiest and the most powerful have a tax incentive to be helping poor people. Now, you know, kind of setting aside the fact that, okay, if they have a tax incentive, that means that they're not paying taxes for other things like other normal infrastructure, which means what? You and I are paying for it? I mean, the whole thing obviously gets all very, very, very complex in a way, but at the same time, it's really very simple. You can just boil it down to this very simple notion. The conservative worldview is that a powerful elite should run the country because that's the best and most stable thing. And they truly believe that. And there's actually a lot of evidence for that. Literally 7,000 years of civilization. Evidence that a wealthy and powerful elite running a nation, whether it's Rome or whether it's pre and post democratic Greece, or whether it's the Mayan Empire, or whether it's the British Empire or the Spanish Empire, whatever it may be, that is a very stable, or the Catholic Church ruling throughout the Dark Ages, really most of Europe, that these hierarchical institutions where the power resides in a small number of people is a very stable form of government. The conservatives are right about that. The problem is, we in the United States back in 1776 said, stability is nice. But number one, we think that there's another way to achieve it, and frankly, a better way to achieve it, and that's to turn to the people and bring them in on the process. And if the maximum number of people are involved in this, if the largest number of possible people are involved in governance, then what's going to happen is you're going to have a government that not only is stable, but also is essentially psychologically and spiritually healthy. The old thing about democracies don't declare wars on other democracies. And that in order to have the people involved in governance, there's this one requisite or prerequisite, and that is that the people must be educated. And not just educated on how to pass a test that some corporation is selling to our schools so that you know, Neil Bush's testing company can make more money. Truly educated. Critical thinking skills. I mean, just the fundamental stuff of a true education. And that's the primary cleavage between the conservative worldview and the liberal or progressive worldview, and it's just a very, very real one. John in Warren, Ohio on the line, 866-440-8466, our telephone number. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Yes, I don't know what fantasy land these individuals who want to push these school vouchers are living in, but I would think that if you wanted to fix the public school system, the last thing you would want to do is take money out of it and put kids into schools, charter schools and voucher schools, that don't have accredited teachers, that, two, don't have the rounded curriculum that public schools offer, that, three, don't offer the social structure for these kids that public schools offer. The only reason that these public schools want these vouchers is so they can go out and get the poor black student to play basketball or play football at their Catholic school. The kids who truly deserve these vouchers, you know, the 4.0 students whose parents are making $12,000 or less a year, aren't going to be the ones who get the vouchers. The ones who are going to get the vouchers are the kids who can run for 250 yards a football game or score 35 points a basketball game and get a 1.5 GPA.
Yeah, good point, John. And you said, you know, you can't understand why they would want to do this. The simple matter is that the conservative worldview, again, to quote Russell Kirk's 1953 book, The Conservative Mind, which was the one that got William F. Buckley and Barry Goldwater and everybody else going, it's literally today the Bible of the conservative movement, as Kevin Phillips points out in his books. In that book, Russell Kirk says, the conservative worldview requires that society have classes and orders. And the reason why these guys are willing to pull money out of public schools is because the people who are at the lower end, and frankly the middle end, of the socioeconomic strata, they think of as they're the worker bees or they're disposable. And the people at the high end of the socioeconomic strata, they are the future leaders, and we need to do everything that we can to empower them and educate them and give them the ability to become the future. And that's the fundamental of their worldview. The idea that somebody, you know, somebody like Bill Clinton, you know, the kid of an alcoholic father from Hope, Arkansas, can grow up to be president, that's not part of their plan. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
That's right. For the first time in our lives.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day, or our let's say back to back juxtaposed quotes for the day. And we're broadly talking about school vouchers, but there's a lot of other news here out. And the first quote is from Osama bin Laden. March of 1997, this is when he declared that the U.S., because in 1991 we had put soldiers into Saudi Arabia, and the men were drinking alcohol and watching pornography, and they were not Muslims, and the women were showing their elbows and driving cars, and all this was absolutely intolerable. They were defiling the Holy Land, and the corrupt royal family was selling oil to us and to the world for $16, $18 a barrel, and thus squandering the precious natural resources of the homeland, of his homeland, it's of Osama bin Laden. So his two demands, that the price of oil go up to maybe $70 a barrel, and that American troops leave Saudi Arabia, which George Bush did just about a year ago this month, I think, about 12 months ago, George W. Bush finally pulled all of the U.S. troops out of Saudi Arabia. So Osama bin Laden has gotten what he wanted, and he's still free. Anyhow, here's bin Laden's quote, his fatwa against America, March 1997. We declare jihad against the U.S. government because the U.S. government is unjust, criminal, and tyrannical. It has committed acts that are extremely unjust, hideous, and criminal. And now here's where he gets into justifying the death of civilians. He says, as for what you asked regarding the American people, they are not exonerated from responsibility because they chose this government and voted for it despite their knowledge of its crimes in Palestine, Lebanon, Iraq, and in other places. End of quote. So here's Osama bin Laden saying, death of civilians? Well, hey, it's because they're supporting a government that is doing things that I disagree with. Okay, that's our quote one for the day. Here's our quote two for the day. It's from Rush Limbaugh, and on his program yesterday, quote, until civilians, frankly, I'm not sure how many of them are actually just innocent little civilians running around versus active Hezbollah types, particularly the men, but until those civilians start paying the price for propping up these kinds of regimes, it's not going to end, folks. What do you mean civilians start paying the price? I just ask you to consult history for the answer to that. End of quote from Rush Limbaugh. So there you have it. Rush Limbaugh and Osama bin Laden saying essentially exactly the same thing. The death of civilians because of the behavior of their government or of people who claim to represent them is a legitimate and appropriate thing. If you've got the creeps, I do too. That's incredible. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Julian, welcome to the program.
Hi, that was creepy.
Yeah. So our creepy moment for the day.
Yes, it was. Andrew Coulson saying the United States educational system is on the bottom of industrialized countries. Unless I'm mistaken, all the other industrialized countries have government-run educational systems.
Yes, without exception.
All right, so government isn't the problem.
Yeah, that's a good starting point. Yep.
Yeah. So whatever is the problem, that's not it.
Yeah. And and that's where the 3 points that I was making to him is number one, as I said, you have a lot of people who are defined as illiterate in the United States, but it's really not that they're illiterate; it's that English isn't their first language. Secondly, we have a 26-year history of a war on public education started by Ronald Reagan and other conservatives, cutting back. And number three, we have an extremely regressive social system in the United States that essentially creates, I don't want to say creates poverty, but is perpetuating poverty. I mean, we're not providing people with the bootstraps. We need to go back to Franklin Roosevelt's idea that the best anti-poverty program is a job, and that if you want to stimulate an economy and you want to build a middle class, you pump money into the working people at the working level, and it will work its way up because they'll create demand, which will cause business people to say, hey, I can build a business to supply this demand, and that will create industry, which will create jobs, which will then create more demand because you'll have more people who are employed who have more money to spend. And it's classic bottom-up economics, and the conservatives don't believe in that. They really believe that the power and goodness of a society lies with the wealthy elite and the social institutions that represent them at the top. And so as a consequence of that, Reagan began rolling back all of the anti-poverty programs that LBJ put in place, and here we are. So we have this triple whammy. We've got massive swaths of poverty in the United States, tens of millions of people living below the poverty line. Tens of millions of, literally, of people who are food insecure. They don't know where their meal is, at least one day out of the month, they don't know where their next meal is going to come from, or the next day, number one. Number two, you've got this cutting of funding right across the board, plus all of the tax cuts for the wealthy, causing government programs to be cut back, and going to block grants and all these other kinds of things. So school funding is down. Schools are having to increasingly, and more desperately turn to local sources of funding, and they're getting a lot of resistance there. And, I'm getting redundant here, but good point, Julie. Thank you very much. Alan in Arlington, Texas on the line. Hey, Alan.
Yeah, just a comment and a quick question. Just my question is going to be off topic, but my comment speaks to it broadly. My comment is, you know, the present day conservatives would probably have a little bit more credibility with me as a citizen if on these on their views on these social programs that they disdain so much, if, you know, they would quit doing these unnecessary wars and tripling the defense budget before their unnecessary wars, which they, you know, they account off the books. Now, what do you think? You know, I mean, guns or butter, I mean, it's gotten a little out of whack, you know?
Yeah, it's a tough one because you have many countries in the world where, for example, the police are essentially not armed. I mean, you know, and very rarely do the police carry weapons, and very low levels of gun violence. Great Britain, for example. Yes, some of the police now are armed, but not the majority of them. And you get this whole thing about, you know, being guns being out there. That's like the micro to the macro, you know, as countries then become massively armed, they have all this stuff. I mean, well, gee, let's use it, right? And you've got whole constituencies promoting the use of that. And this is why Thomas Jefferson said back in the 1770s, and pushed so hard to have written into the Constitution as the Second Amendment that during times of peace, the army would be dissolved. And just like in Switzerland, and that the army would only emerge during times of war, but that every male between the ages of 17 and 47 would be a member of a local militia who could then be enlisted if the country was invaded. But basically the purpose of the military was to stop invasions, not to say, hey, we need energy, and ExxonMobil wants to drill for oil over in Saudi Arabia, so let's put a giant footprint in the Middle East, rather than saying, you know, because we have the military means to do it, instead of saying, hey, you know, we need energy, let's figure out how to get solar power.
One other thing I point to as hypocritical from these guys is, you know, Clinton was tough on crime. That cops program, from what I understand, was working and working well.
It was. He put 100,000 cops on the street.
Yeah, and they cut the funding to it. My question is off topic, but you hopefully answer it real quick. I've just really recently started following politics, and I hear this comment, you know, this expletive that Dick Cheney hurled at Pat Leahy from the Senate floor, and I hear it played from time to time and alluded to, but I don't know the context of it. What was that about anyway? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks a lot for the call. You know, it's funny because I saw Pat Leahy just shortly after that and spoke with him, and I don't remember the specific context myself right now. It was for a photo. They were all on the floor of the Senate, and there was 8 or 10 of them together, and Cheney, you know, told Pat Leahy that he could go beat himself, and I don't frankly remember the context. I'm sorry. So. Dave in Louisiana? No. Okay, Bill in Chicago. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Bill, love your program. Listen, on the comments on the guy from the Cato Institute, I just love these libertarians. Anyway, I noticed a number of years ago when I was watching I think it was Charlie Rhodes or something, Milton Friedman was on, and Julian from Grand Rapids made the same point. They always make the comparison to countries that have strong public education systems.
Mm-hmm.
This is where all your top scores come out of. This is it. And the countries sometimes they mention will be France or whatever, and they have very centralized education systems, but they're well-funded. And they have strong teachers' unions in most of these countries also. Japanese do. So I don't understand their point with this criticizing public education here, but comparing it to the superlative public education systems of these other countries.
Well, it gets back to this just core fundamental philosophy that things like high quality education should be the province of the upper classes. I mean, that's the conservative worldview. It's an elitist worldview. It's one of the reasons that cons like Limbaugh on radio forever have been saying things like the liberal elite, because the conservatives really do believe in an elite. And so, you know, their strategy is to label the opposition as what they are. It's just very simple. Thanks a lot for the call, Bill. Appreciate it. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The end of the line is in your mind, and you'll be staying in your mind.
In your mind.
In your mind.
In your mind.
Bone for bone and skin for skin, eye for eye and tooth for tooth, heart for heart and soul for soul. Somebody said, what is true? Lock it up and close it down. The sound of mourning like a dove. High beyond the rattle and roar. Look into the face of love.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Dave in Los Angeles, California on the line. Hey, Dave.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say on this school voucher program that this is a Leo Strauss, who acknowledged as the father of the neoconservative movement. This is his dream. And he always believed that people should be kept uninformed and that there should be two classes. And if I can, I'll read two quick sentences from two essays. There's a small number of men who know the detailed truth. The masses are told what they need to know and no more. Free inquiry outside the bounds of revelation is dangerous. And another sentence from another essay is, principles of the neoconservatives that are now in power in our nation believe that the common people were unable to deal with the truth, that there is no God, no nation, no justice, no equality, no God-given human rights. Noble lies are necessary to govern properly. If not deceived, the people will lead the nation to destruction.
Yeah, this is, and Leo Strauss, the modern thinker of this, although he wasn't saying anything new. I mean, you could go back and read The Prince by Machiavelli, which is written in the, as I recall, in the 1500s, and it's not that much different. I mean, the core notion, though, and Dave, your quote is spot on, that I wouldn't say so much that Strauss didn't want people to be educated. He just wanted them to be educated in a particular way. He wanted them to believe the mythos of nationalism. He wanted them to be, frankly, Strauss also believed that religion should play a role in this, that there should be a national religion in essence. And he was suggesting that it could be Christianity. It should be Christianity, in fact, even though he was Jewish.
Because one of the things he did is he freely acknowledged in his classes at Chicago University, also home of Milton Friedman, that his classes and his books were fairly a sham. He just wrote them because he had to, and that there was no real knowledge in them.
Well, he wrote two kinds of things. He wrote the stuff for the students and the masses, and then he kind of wrote in code for people like Paul Wolfowitz and Feith and Pearl and his serious inner circle disciples.
He pulled those people aside and he instructed them. And this, with what the school voucher program would do this, would help do this, segregate the masses into those that know and those that don't.
Yeah, absolutely. Dave, thanks for the call. Good point. And in fact, there's an excellent book on Leo Strauss that was one of my BuzzFlash Book of the Month suggestions. If you go to buzzflash.com and find anything on there that I go to my Book of the Month and just click on that. And in the upper right-hand corner of my Book of the Month review, I'm forgetting which one it is right now this month, but in any case, you go to the Book of the Month, there's a thing that says Hartman's Previous Recommendations. Click on that. There's a list of, 2 years worth of my books of the month, where I recommend, this is my contribution to BuzzFlash. You can contribute to BuzzFlash.com by buying a book from them. That's how they support their website. I contribute to them by writing the book reviews for them, for free and all that kind of stuff. And one of the books that I reviewed is a book about Leo Strauss, which I've read several, and I thought it was probably the very best. I'm sorry I don't recall the top or the author or the title right off the top of my head, but it's right there at BuzzFlash.com. KJ in Camas, Washington. Hey, KJ, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I found your little comment about worker bees interesting, that they want to make us all their little worker bees.
In fact, over the last 20 years, or really over the last 40 years, workers have gone from being viewed as the producers in society to being viewed as a resource, human resource departments. I mean, when I was a kid, nobody referred to people, workers, as resources. And, it's just the whole euphemism of human resource. Well, you've got your natural resources, you've got your human resources. Yeah.
Just a little warning, having gathered honey in my time, bees have a real bad habit of stinging.
Yeah, there you go. When enough of them get together. Thanks a lot, KJ, for the call. And that by the way, brings us back to the idea that of democracy, which I write about in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? The study that was published in Nature 2 years ago that was just mind-boggling, that found that in nature, animals behave in a democratic fashion. They're always voting constantly. And they're, you know, yes, there are apparent leader animals, but those leader animals primarily just have first choice of sexual mate. I mean, that's it, you know, so that they can pass on the strongest genes. But when it comes to what the, you know, which direction the herd is going to go, or how the flock is going to fly, or how the school of fish is going to swim, or where, there's millions of little micro votes going on at all times, and it's majority rule. Democracy is the natural state of nature. Dave in Eureka, California. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I'm feeling a strong need to try to get a point across. We've debated it, I think, a bit before. But I hear you in a way finding an ideology about what I consider to be hardcore psychopathic criminals that have stolen our government, are driven by pure greed, are willing to set up major events of mass death to get their way.
But see, all the things you just described, Dave, could also be described as an ideology. All you need is a rationalization to wrap it up with. You know, the ends justify the means. They're like Hitler, 1,000 years apiece.
We don't want to make excuses for Hitler, or we don't want to make...
No, I'm not. These are not excuses. This is how these guys sell this stuff. That's my point.
I'm of the belief, and I know you are too, as a fellow mental health professional, that the key to solving problems, the key to mental health, is to be directly in tune to reality.
Yeah.
If these...
Go ahead. You got another 30 seconds here.
If these guys are just pure hardcore criminals out to grab everything that they can and do as much harm to the people as they can, these are the people that you don't say the ideology. This is just...
But Dave, I'm sure you've dealt with criminals. You know that they still look themselves in the mirror at night. They have a rationalization for what they do.
Not one that I would ever say for them. Let them tell their own lives.
Okay, all righty. Yeah, good point. Dave, I appreciate the call, and it's always good to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We're going to be back. What do we have next here? Colleen Kelly about the IRS cutting estate and gift tax attorneys right after this.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Abraham Lincoln: "We the people are the rightful masters of both Congress and the courts, not to overthrow the Constitution, but to overthrow the men who pervert the Constitution." Sort of reminds you of Tom DeLay lighting up a cigar in a restaurant where the guy said, the waiter came over and said, "I'm sorry, sir, but the law says that it's no smoking in this building." And Tom DeLay said, "I am the law." Yes. Colleen Kelly is with us. The website NTEU, the National Treasury Employees Union.org, NTEU.org, as in National Treasury Employees Union. And Colleen Kelly, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
Colleen, strange goings on over at the IRS right now. Tell us about this.
Well, the IRS has decided that they are going to eliminate nearly half of the workforce of estate tax attorneys who audit the returns of estates that are filed across the country today. And these estates, of course, are the tax returns of the wealthiest Americans. The average American will never file an estate tax or a gift tax return with the limits that are in place. So this is about estates that are large and that owe taxes to the federal government. And with the idea that they are going to eliminate close to half of this workforce, it means that many of these estates will not be audited and will not pay the proper taxes that are due, while every other American who has their taxes withheld from their paycheck by their employer will be paying their fair share.
I understand at the same time that the Bush administration has ramped up IRS prosecution against low-income families who are claiming tax credits that are typically in the range of $100 to $1,000. For various things. Is that the case?
Well, there are many reports out there about increases in audits of low-income taxpayers who are looking for earned income credits and other deductions. And this comes down to a question of resources. The resources the IRS has, whether it has appropriate resources, and then how it chooses to use them. So the idea that they would walk away from the audits of these estates, which, according to the IRS commissioner of that division, says that for every 1 hour they spend auditing these estate tax returns, an average of $2,200 additional dollars are collected and returned to the Treasury. That is billions of dollars that are needed to fund the government agencies. And also, again, it's just the appropriate tax due, and the estates should have to pay their share as required by law, just as all Americans do.
But, you know, George Bush came from a family that is now in aggregate worth over $1 billion. Dick Cheney is a multimillionaire. Many of the people in the cabinet are 100 millionaires or multimillionaires. None of these guys want to pay estate taxes. None of them think that estate taxes should be paid. You've got these 18 wealthy families who have funded, it's just been outed in the press in the last few months that over a 10-year period have funded folks like Grover Norquist and this whole covert so-called grassroots program to end the estate tax, arguing that for example, it's harming small businesses and family farmers, when in fact I believe it was the Chamber of Commerce was asked to find one family farm that was lost to the estate tax. They were unable to do it. And this was the New York Times. They wanted to do a story highlighting the plight of family farmers. I mean, it was going to be a friendly story, and they couldn't find one. So these folks have been pushing really, really hard to end the estate tax for a long time. Seems to me, Colleen Kelly, that by laying off roughly half of the enforcement folks at the IRS who are focusing on the estate tax, the Bush administration is simply doing an end run around Congress, around the legislative process. They're saying, okay, if you guys won't repeal this law, we will simply make it impossible for it to be enforced.
Well, there are many who believe that, and I do not think it's a stretch when you just look at the facts. The idea that today there are only 341 estate tax attorneys even doing this work, and that they hope to eliminate close to half of them, would leave very few employees in place to focus on this this high income and tax-producing work. You're absolutely right about that. And as far as Congress goes, the IRS announced this just about 3 weeks ago, this reorganization to eliminate nearly half of the workforce, and they did it with the intention of having these employees off of the rolls by September 30th. They wanted to do this quickly, and they wanted to do it without calling attention to it. They were hoping no one would notice, including Congress, and that has not been the case. There has been a lot of interest and a lot of publicity around this, and Congress is asking an awful lot of questions. Just this past week, a letter was sent to the commissioner of the IRS by 23 members of Congress who are demanding information about the allocation of their audit resources, how they spend the money, which returns they focus on, the impact of the proposed reduction in this staffing, and what that will have, the impact will be on the audits from filed returns. So Congress is looking at this, and this is exactly what the IRS wanted not to happen. The IRS was hoping they could just shuffle the workforce, move out half of this workforce, change their focus, and have no one the wiser. But that is not the case, and it's not the case in large part due to the interest of the public and the media and to reporters like you.
I'm guessing Colleen Kelly with the National Treasury Employees Union, NTEU.org is the website. I'm guessing that if I were an employee of the Internal Revenue Service auditing, for example, the returns of the billionaires among us, and I was reassigned to auditing people who make $30,000 a year and are looking for earned income tax credits, and I protested that my job would be at risk. Am I correct in guessing that there are very few people inside the IRS who are willing to speak out on this, and that without a union, we probably never would have even known about this?
Well, that is a fact. Employees are concerned. They see NTEU as an opportunity to have their voice heard, and it was NTEU who because of the information we had from employees, brought this issue to the forefront. NTU's role as the representative of employees, you're absolutely right, Tom, is what unions are about, to give the voice to employees that otherwise would be stifled.
And this may have something to do with why George W. Bush has declared that he wants to eliminate 800,000 government jobs and replace them with private contractors, which would mean that they would no longer be members of unions like NTEU and no longer be blowing whistles, as it were.
Well, that's true. Many of the actions of this administration have been focused against federal employees. They have done nothing to support the work of these dedicated and hardworking men and women who do the work of our federal government every day. And if they had their way, you're absolutely right, they would replace 800,000 of them is what they have targeted with contractors who would have no, they would not be career employees, they would have no loyalty, no commitment, no dedication, and they would have no access to be represented by a union and to have their voice heard. They would do as they were told, or they would be replaced.
We're talking with Colleen Kelly. She's the president of the National Treasury Employees Union. NTEU.org is their website. And Colleen Kelly, and coincidentally, in today's news, there's a story about how apparently as much as $1 trillion, perhaps more, has been probably illegally, certainly questionably legally, not paid in taxes by the very most wealthy among us, to the tune of about $40 billion a year is the best guess, through mostly offshore tax shelters and tax havens. I believe it was USA Today had it on their cover story today, and I was, in fact, reading it on the way over to the radio station this morning. Do you, and you're, with the knowledge that you have of how these things work, any sense of what chunk of that might have to do with the estate tax versus just plain old garden variety, hiding income?
I really wouldn't have a sense of any kind of a percentage, Tom, but that report of taxes not being paid by the wealthiest, that's the news today. But you can find reports back to 5 years ago where when Congress deals with the tax gap, as it's known, the difference between the taxes paid and taxes that are due under the law, they target the wealthiest taxpayers as very often being a large percentage of that tax gap. And the estates surely are a part of it. Regardless of what the percentage is, even according to the IRS, this is an examination program that produces additional dollars that are legitimately due to the government. And absent that audit, those taxes would never be paid.
Colleen Kelly, we just have a few seconds left. What can our listeners do about this?
Our listeners should contact their congressional representatives, congressmen, and senators. Let them know that the IRS's use of the workforce and their attempt to eliminate this estate tax audit program is wrong, that as taxpayers they are angry that these wealthiest Americans would not be required to pay their fair share as these average Americans do.
Well said. And the toll-free number for Congress, 1-888-355-3588 for your member of Congress. That number is also on our homepage at tomhartmann.com. Is there contact information at NTEU.org as well, Colleen?
There is on our website and information about this specific issue, Tom.
Great. www.NTEU, as in National Treasury Employees Union.org. Colleen Kelly, the president of the National Treasury Employees Union. Colleen, thanks for the great work that you're doing.
Thank you, Tom.
And keep it up.
You too.
It's just marvelous that you're speaking out there. I will. Nothing's going to stop me. It's 16 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartmann radio program. We'll be right back. Correspondent Nurse Victoria with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com.
Yes, indeed. And I'm in our mobile unit today. Well, I'm in our ambulance today. Excuse me. I'm driving the ambulance today. I just drove past Bethesda Naval Hospital where President Bush still is. He's been there since 8 o'clock this morning having his annual physical. He's about to leave and head back to the White House. And that actually is the only thing, according to his weekly schedule, that he's doing in Washington, D.C. this week. That's it. He's only in Washington for today, and that is the only thing on his schedule for today. He is off again tomorrow and on Thursday, and then he heads to Crawford.
So let's see. Let me get this right. We've got the possibility of World War III happening in the Middle East. We've got Taiwan talking about arming themselves against China, this whole eruption of stuff in Taiwan now going on, and China, of course, those problems. We have an $800 billion trade deficit with the rest of the world. We've got a $300 million a budget deficit. We've got an $8 trillion, $9 trillion total debt. Over the weekend, we were visiting Michigan, and my brother's daughter just had a baby, and he was born with $28,000 in debt on that George Bush ran up. George Bush and Ronald Reagan, between the two of them, ran up for him. And with all of this, and global warming is really starting to actually wipe out big chunks of the United States, and George Bush has nothing on his calendar?
That's correct. He's getting himself checked out to see if he's completely healthy. He keeps himself very fit. And that is all he has on his calendar this week.
Is there, Victoria, a mental health examination going to happen today?
Well, the exam itself is 5 hours long, and I've been trying to work out all day what it is that takes that long, and maybe it is the mental exam. Or maybe that's the quick part, the mental exam. Maybe that doesn't take very long.
Amazing. So what's happening with Congress this week?
The House is officially out, although there are a couple of committees that are lingering. Senate is not finished. It's continuing its business. Interesting, Alberto Gonzalez will be testifying tomorrow before, I think it's judiciary, but I'm not sure. And once again, we'll all be watching because we want to see how many different ways we can find to listen and hear him say, I don't know the answer to that question, and if I did, I'm not going to tell you.
Yeah.
So that's always fascinating.
Now, one of the things that I find most curious is that John Boehner, however you say it, has literally said that he has the right to simply rename a piece of legislation because it's politically useful. Here you have this immigration bill, which is, I don't want to say broadly unpopular, but broadly viewed with suspicion by Americans. And the Republicans intend to run against, frankly, in 2006. They think that this is going to be their magic bullet that's going to bring down the Democrats, is the whole issue of amnesty for illegal immigrants here in the United States. And the bill is actually the McCain-Kennedy bill. I mean, John McCain and Ted Kennedy are the two who put the thing together. And traditionally you refer to, I mean, that's not the official name of it, but traditionally you refer to a bill by its two primary sponsors, which are John McCain and Ted Kennedy. But John Boehner keeps referring to this, or Boehner keeps referring to this thing as the Reid-Kennedy bill. In other words, instead of a Republican and a Democrat, it's a Democrat and a Democrat. Setting this thing up, of course, for the big guns to come after it. If he can rename it the Reid-Kennedy bill, then you know during the election in November, they'll be firing all guns blazing. Number one, has this ever happened before, to the best of your knowledge? Number two, go ahead.
I can say I've never heard of such a thing.
Really?
Yes. It's,
yeah, I find it just astounding. And Boehner just says, you know, he can do that. I mean, you know, you just, I'm going to do it. And number two, do you think it's going to work?
Well, I think it could work if anybody knows who Reid is.
I beg your pardon?
Well, I mean, the general public isn't as familiar with who if they mean Harry Reid, isn't as familiar with who he is.
Yeah.
So it might not work, but it's really very, very odd. I wouldn't have thought McCain would be too happy about it either.
Yeah, although you wonder, you know, to what extent the Republican leadership cares about John McCain right now.
Well, there's some truth to that, too.
Yeah, yeah. Now, John Boehner, how do you say it?
Boehner,
thank you. John Boehner is also calling now a new call for the privatization of Social Security. Where do you think this is going to go?
I think it's going to go absolutely nowhere. They're in a position where whatever majority they've got is likely to be slimmed down, to put it politely, unless the Democrats manage to massively screw up. So I don't see how it's going to go anywhere.
Yeah, that's my take on it, too. I'm just amazed that he's even willing to touch it. But we'll see how it shakes out. Victoria Jones, our senior nursing correspondent here today, checking in on the physical and mental health of George W. When you find out how he's doing, let us know, eh?
Thank you.
Okay, Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Great talking with you today. It's 29 minutes past the hour. 27 minutes.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Play something country. Now, play something country.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the studios of Talk 1090 in Seattle, Washington, where last night we did a gig with Congressman Jim McDermott, one of the finest members of the United States House of Representatives, and former President Bill Clinton. And, boy, it was a barn burner. It was just absolutely great.
Timothy Carney's on the line. He's the author of a new book, The Big Ripoff, How Big Business and Big Government Steal Your Money. Timothy Carney, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Tim
is good.
Tim, I noticed that you're listed on the American Enterprise Institute site as a contributor, and that Robert Nobrak wrote the foreword to your book. I've had a number of guests from the American Enterprise Institute on, and they're always on the side of big business. What's up?
Well, I got to say straight there, the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Competitive Enterprise, you're right. Yeah, thank you.
My friends recommended your show to me, so I've been looking forward to this. But on the side of big business, if by that you mean sticking up for free markets, then yes. And I can't speak for the rest of my friends, but sometimes for people who want limited government, who want lower taxes, who want fewer and less burdensome regulations, you find that big business is not on your side and instead on the side of the left in Washington, looking for bigger government and stricter government control over the economy. And in my book, in The Big Ripoff...
On the side of the left?
I tell story after story of big business on the side of the left. Chuck Schumer, I think, qualifies as a liberal. Is that fair?
No, I would say Chuck Schumer is a conservative Democrat. He's a DLC Democrat. The whole, you know as well as I do, Tim Carney, that the DLC is the Republican faction of the Democratic Party.
But you're basing that strictly on foreign policy?
No, I'm not. I'm basing it on domestic policy, things like NAFTA and CAFTA and tax policy and the energy.
Barbara Lee. How about Barbara Lee? Does she fit into your definition of a liberal there?
I don't know her voting record.
Barbara Lee is a congresswoman from Oakland, California. She was the one person to vote against the authorization for the use of force after 9/11. She's promoted a bill called something like the Fair Wages for All Act, which would double the minimum wage, provide mandatory health insurance. It's sort of a socialist dream. And she's on the Financial Services Committee, she gets more money from the financial services industry than her fellow committee mate, Ron Paul, who is the only consistent advocate of lower taxes and less regulation.
Yeah, Ron Paul, the Republican from Texas, I have to say, is probably one of the most consistent and Ted and Bernie Sanders probably are the two who are absolutely principle-driven in all cases. And Peter DeFazio is right up there on that list. But the point that you make, Tim, and I think that, frankly, you and I have, although, you know, you like to toss in these words like on the left, but I think that you and I both have many of the same concerns. I wrote a book called Unequal Protection, which is totally nonpartisan. In fact, a lot of conservatives recommend the book about how corporations have seized so much power in American politics and how inappropriate and, frankly, unlawful it is. It's inconsistent with the founding vision of this country.
Well, I agree with you, but looking at some of your books, the way that my book, The Big Ripoff, disagrees is that I think that what corporations have done with that power is not to push for free markets, but to push for higher taxes, for example, or stricter regulation.
Lower taxes for them, higher taxes for us.
Well, exactly. I mean, Warren Buffett, who lobbies, he helped save the estate tax that we call the death tax. He helped save that this last year, as together with the life insurance industry. What Warren Buffett does is he buys undervalued businesses, and on many occasions he's bought businesses that were motivated sellers because the heirs were facing the death tax and they had to sell it.
It was actually the heirs of the Walton family who were the major funders of this stealth campaign to do away with the estate tax.
And then you want to talk about the Walmart company.
Here's what baffles me, Tim. To return to Tim Carney, his book, The Big Ripoff, and the website, TimothyPCarney.com, here's an issue that, frankly, I think transcends partisan politics. Democrats, there are corrupt Democrats, there are corrupt Republicans. What we have is a system that has become corrupted.
Mm-hmm.
Why try to turn it into a partisan issue?
Well, I don't try to turn it into a partisan issue.
You're certainly doing it in this interview.
You woke me up from a nap and I'm feeling a little bit feisty here.
Okay.
I do believe, though, that the problem of corrupt politicians is one whose solution is not going to be that you're not going to like my proposed solution, which is to say the way to get rid of corruption in high places is to get rid of the high places. As long as politicians have so much control over our money and our freedom, that is, as long as the regulatory burden is so high and the taxes are so high, then the sort of corruption is inevitable.
But as you point out in your book, it's big business that's asking for these regulations because regulations essentially establish for them monopolies or thresholds that prevent them from being sued. For example, with asbestos, you had, you know, big mining companies lobbying for a 10 parts per billion limit of asbestos in the water. Why? Because 7 parts per billion will cause cancer, but they knew that if the federal government set the limit at 10 parts per billion, as long as they're at 10 or below, they can't be sued.
And you get regulations of that sort all the time.
Right.
You had Enron lobbying for the Kyoto Global Warming Treaty, knowing that their natural gas pipelines would be worth more. Their coal-fired power plants in the third world would be unaffected by Kyoto, which only really clamps down on the developed world.
So why not have a solution that says, let's get money out of politics?
Because getting money out of politics is like keeping ants away from like food in the dumpster. There's no good way to do it. The money will come to politics.
Well, other countries have done it very successfully. In the United Kingdom, for example, if you're running for parliament, you can't spend more than £100,000. Period.
Sure. I have freedom of speech issues with regard to.
So you think that a corporation is a person and that money is speech?
No. You were talking about politicians, curbs on politicians there. And look at George Soros. George Soros funded all this McCain-Feingold business, then becomes the number one funder of 527s in the 2004 election. Now is involved with an effort to.
Look at Joe Kors. Look at the Walton family heirs. I mean, you know, we've got,
saying,
you know, look at Richard Nolan Scaife. My point is none of these people should be able to influence politics.
I know, but I was pointing to George Soros as one of the big backers of the last push at campaign finance reform, and that was not a legitimate effort to get money out of politics.
Well, I think it started out that way. Wouldn't you agree that both McCain and Feingold had good intentions in the beginning and the thing ended up going through the sausage machine, you know?
That's the way it works, is that you get politicians with, and I love Feingold, sometimes, I mean, I'm sure I feel the same way about him that you'll feel about a Ron Paul or a Tom Coburn. You admire his, I admire his consistency but the politicians start with the good intentions, and then once the gears on the sausage grinder start turning, then all of a sudden, who gets involved?
Right. So let's change the sausage grinder. You know, in the last presidential election, about $2 billion was spent. You know, total in federal campaigns across the United States. If every taxpayer in America ponied up about what $5 a year, I believe it is. That would be, I have to do the math in my head really fast, but that would be $20 over a four-year period. There's 150 million taxpayers, four times that. That's $800 million. That's nearly $1 billion right there. And very simple thing. Let's just go to public funding of elections. $5 a year it's going to cost all of us to get big money out of politics. And that is constitutional and it is legal. It's being done in two states, in Maine and Arizona.
And I have trouble with a politics tax. You're talking about giving government control, you're talking about giving politicians control over the money that will be spent on politics.
No, I'm talking about we the people. In the United States, we have a democratic republic here. The government is us, it's not them.
You and I are talking about the ways in which we've lost control over our government.
To largely corporate entities, yes.
And I think that the entrenched politicians and bureaucrats are have as much of a that's why I talk about big business and big government stealing your money.
I agree. No, you know, very few. The only politician that I know of who has called for systematic, you know, public financing of campaigns at a national level is Bernie Sanders. There may be a few others out there, but I haven't heard from them. But it just seems like, you know, a reasonable idea.
I am just very.
You'd rather have the corporations and George Soros paying the piper for our political process.
I'd rather have those congressional seats not be worth as much money. I'd rather have.
But how do you do that?
Government not have as much power over my life.
So you want to limit the ability of we the people to regulate the institutions that we create.
I mean, you can phrase it that way, but 5 minutes ago, again, you were saying, I think it's inevitable. I think what's happened in Washington today, once government power gets increased, then the rich and the already powerful will have their hands on that steering wheel. If you devolve power back to states and individuals and towns, that devolves more power back to we the people. And that,
well, then, if that's the case, then why are the Republicans fighting, for example, conservatives fighting so hard to have national standards for food labeling that would invalidate literally hundreds of more strict local regulations all across the United States?
Well, I think you can guess why Republicans are doing
that. Or are we on the same side of this issue, Timothy?
Yeah, we are. That's a major.
All right, so that's a good example. We have we're flat out of time. Tim Carney, the big ripoff. However, one of our listeners has a quick question for you, Mark in Tualatin. You're live with Timothy Carney.
Yeah, you know, I was wondering what does your guest say about the tax deferment, the laws that we give, for taxes to people at Bank and Cayman Islands and offshore. I'll take
yeah.
the answer.
Okay, yeah. Why should Halliburton be able to get hundreds of billions of dollars or tens of billions of dollars from the United States government with a guaranteed profitability and then reincorporate KBR in the Cayman Islands so that they don't have to pay us taxes on the money that they're making with our money?
And that's another aspect of how the tax code allows people who already have lots of money to make lots of money. You and I couldn't benefit very much from those tax.
So it's another. This is another area where we agree. Another example of what you call the big ripoff in your book, The Big Ripoff: How Big Business and Big Government Steal Your Money. Book by Timothy Carney. His website: Timothy P. Carney, CARNEY.com. Right.
Yep, that's okay. Right. And the book's available now online and in bookstores.
Okay, great. Tim, great having you on the program. Thanks for being
Tom.
With us. It's 46 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be back right after this. Our number, 1-866-440-8466. We'll be taking your calls after this.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you in the third hour of our program. A new military flashpoint. A new military flashpoint. The Taiwan Strait. Nobody's looking, right? Nobody's looking. Oh man, here we have North Korea is building nuclear weapons. Pakistan is building nuclear weapons. India, with the help of the United States, is going to be building nuclear weapons. And the president, the president's dealing with the crisis of stem cells. But this in the Christian Science Monitor. There is a new flashpoint, a new military flashpoint in the region, the Southeast Asian region, the Taiwan Strait, that is in the midst of missile tensions. They say a private TV station reported earlier this month that Taiwan's military was preparing to test fire a tactical missile in September capable of striking targets in China. Now, you know, there's the two main parties in Taiwan, at least two of the main parties in Taiwan have as
you know, at the core of some of their major differences. The debate over whether China, whether Taiwan should declare itself independent of China, which would be tantamount to declaring war with China, because China has said, no, Taiwan is not a nation, it's a state. It's a province of China, and someday we will reabsorb her. And the Taiwanese have been saying, no way, but we'll go along with this pretense because you're bigger and you're right next door to us. As the walls, this is just Simon Montlake's piece in the Christian Science Monitor. In the event of an imminent attack, now keep in mind, China right now, in terms of military spending, is number two in the world behind the United States. We spend more money militarily right now than all the other countries in the world combined. But among all the other countries in the world, number two right now is China. And if, and an awful lot of that is going to missiles and other things that are pointed at Taiwan. And as Simon Montlake points out, in the event of an imminent attack, Taiwan would be justified in launching a preemptive strike against military targets, and China runs the hawkish argument. Now, you could argue that this is because we've established that, hey, preemptive strikes are just fine. I mean, we did a preemptive strike against a country that didn't even represent any threat to us. As the Christian Science Monitor writes, this should go hand in hand with improved defenses on the island, including advanced interceptor missiles and attack aircraft, says Li Wen-chung, a government legislator in Taiwan. Even if we are going to buy U.S.-made Patriot missiles, we also need to develop our own offensive missiles. Simon Montlake points out, such attitudes present a dilemma for the U.S., which is reportedly urging Taiwan to back off its missile program. U.S. diplomacy in the region is a balancing act between deterring China from invading Taiwan and restraining President Chen Shui-bian on the issue of Taiwanese sovereignty. This is just a very messy situation. Taiwan's, as the Christian Science Monitor points out, Taiwan's indigenous missile program includes a cruise missile with a 1,000-kilometer range and an anti-ship missile that could reach Chinese naval bases. Since 2001, Taiwan's politicians have sparred over a U.S. offer to sell arms valued between $10 and $19 billion. The deal was designed to shore up defenses against a rapidly modernizing Chinese army. So here we are, we're supplying China with money. I mean, trillions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars a year in surplus, and giving China the ability, the means, the necessity, frankly, to buy big chunks of the United States. Right now, most of what they're buying is our debt, but they're also buying our companies. So at the same time we're doing that, we're selling Taiwan $19 billion worth of weapons to point at China. Taiwan is currently targeted by around 800 Chinese-made missiles that would reach the island within 7 minutes of being launched. And then they add one wild card is the run-up to Taiwan's 2008 presidential election, when Chen, the current president of Taiwan, is expected to turn up the rhetoric on Taiwanese sovereignty to rally his base. That could provoke China into the kind of saber-rattling that erupted in 1996 when it test-fired missiles off the coast. And, you know, why should we worry about this? Well, we said, hey, what's the big deal? There's just a war going on in Europe back in the 1930s. And then pretty soon Japan said, no, we're in this thing, too. We're in this thing, too. Speaking of we're all in this thing, too, there's happening all over the planet. Here's the U.S. version of it. If you think you can't divorce things like nuclear power and global warming. In fact, if you think that the answer to global warming, greenhouse gases, the answer, how can we have electricity if we don't burn coal, if we don't burn oil, if we don't burn natural gas, which take carbon, which has been stored in the earth for 300 million years and throw it into the atmosphere where it produces global warming. If you think that the answer to that, as the Bushies clearly do, is nuclear power, think again. This story is a twofer. The first part about what's going on in the United States. This is from the Associated Press. More than 60% of the United States now has abnormally dry or drought conditions. 60% of the United States, stretching from Georgia to Arizona and across the north through the Dakotas, Minnesota, Montana, and Wisconsin. This is from Mark Svoboda, a climatologist for the National Drought Mitigation Center at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. He said an area stretching from south-central North Dakota to central South Dakota is the most drought-stricken region in the nation. He calls it the epicenter. But it's happening all over the country. Crops are dying. Livestock is dying. The price on livestock has fallen through the floor because everybody's trying to unload their cattle because they can't water them. If they don't get rid of them, they're going to die. As the Associated Press notes, farm ponds and other small bodies of water have dried out from the heat, leaving the residual alkali dust to be whipped up by the wind. Brad Ripley, a Federal Agriculture Department meteorologist in Washington, said this year's drought is continuing one that started in the late 1990s. He says the 1999 to 2006 drought ranks only behind the 1930s and the 50s as third worst drought in the period in record period, but we may just be in the beginning of it. They talk about this guy Harold Shoemaker. He owns a livestock company and auction in South Dakota. In May, June, and July last year, his company sold 3,800 cattle. During the same months this year, 27,000 cattle. Why? Because he says these 100 degree days are just killing us. People can't water their cattle. They got to get rid of them. So here we are, as George Bush pointed out this morning in Florida, 5% of the world's population. As he didn't point out, we contribute 25% of the world's greenhouse gases, leading to the warming of the planet, which is leading to an increase in demand for air conditioning, which is causing people in the United States anyway to burn more fossil fuels, which is throwing out more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Well, the solution in Europe, let's try nuclear power. Except for this. This is from yesterday's Observer, the affiliated paper with The Guardian of the United Kingdom, the newspaper. European heat wave has forced nuclear power plants to reduce or halt production. The weather blamed for deaths and disruption across much of the continent has caused dramatic rises in the temperature of rivers used to cool the reactors, raising fears of mass death for fish and other wildlife. You get this? They're having to shut down the nuclear plants because the nuclear plants require cold water, and it's so hot, the cold water's hot. Spain shut down the Santa Maria de Garona reactor in the River Ebro, one of the country's eight nuclear plants, which generate a fifth of its national electricity. Reactors in Germany are cutting output. Others in Germany and France have been given special permits to dump hot water into rivers to avoid power failures, even though this is going to cause massive death of fish. France, where nuclear electricity or power provides more than three-quarters of electricity, is also now having to import power to prevent shortages. They point out the problems have come to light just weeks after Britain declared it will build a new generation of nuclear power stations, prompting opponents to claim the crisis proves nuclear reactors, although they emit no carbon dioxide greenhouse gases, are not a solution to the problem of global warming. Well, you could say they emit no carbon dioxide greenhouse gases, but in the process of mining uranium, refining uranium, transporting uranium, and disposing all of this stuff, at the moment anyway, consumes enormous amounts of oil. Although one can hope that there will be renewable sources of energy that will do it. So it seems like, you know, it's all bad news, right? We have the prospect of war in the Far East, where there is war in the Middle East going on, and global warming producing all these problems. What we need right now is good, competent leadership in the United States. There are all of these problems present opportunities. The problems of war represent opportunities to create lasting peace. The problem of global warming creates an opportunity for us to transition into an economy and a whole brand new world, an economy based on renewable resources. What's lacking? The political will to do it. What's lacking? Well, what's obstructing? The Republican Party, basically. All the more reason that we all get politically active and get active now. 17 minutes past the hour.
democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here. You should tell listeners they can load my... welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program. Alec DeBrow is with us. He's the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ilcaonline.org is the website. Hey, Alec, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. You play the Kinks for me?
For all of us who can remember.
That's right. Well, welcome from the heart of global warming, Washington, D.C.
Indeed. Two things I want to bring up with you, Alec. The first is that the Chicago City Council is talking about forcing Walmart to pay a living wage, but they're not forcing them to accept unions, and it seems like if they did the latter, they wouldn't have to do the former. And the second is about unions in China, but let's go for it here.
Okay. Chicago City Council passed an ordinance requiring big box stores to pay a minimum wage of $10 an hour, but by 2010, and if $3 an hour worth of benefits, and they passed it by enough of a margin so that they can override a veto by the mayor who threatens to veto it. Very interesting. Walmart responded by saying, it's sad this put politics ahead of working men and women. This means Chicago is closed to business. And just lest you think this is only Walmart, apparently Target has met with a number of African-American aldermen in Chicago and told them that they would cancel or delay stores in those neighborhoods if this passes. So it is a big battle, and it's very interesting, and you're sort of right about the lack of union representation. But the truth is the battle for workers' rights has always been two-pronged in this country. It's been both legislative and it's been organizing itself. The 8-hour day, you know, was a national campaign. It wasn't a specific union campaign.
Yeah, but my point is we shouldn't be in such a sad state of affairs. We shouldn't be in a situation where we have to have members of a city council doing work on behalf of labor, of workers, that workers themselves should have the power to do.
Well, you're absolutely right, but the fact is for most of our history, the courts have sided with employers, and that's why they've had to do this. Yeah, it's terrible. The number of employers now who resort to union busting consultants is at an all-time high. At least three-quarters of them do.
No, it's a growth industry. You've got all these guys whose jobs got, you know, all these white-collar workers whose jobs got outsourced to India. They need something to do, so they're becoming consultants to bust unions.
Yeah, apparently there's 2,000 people who specialize in this, and the fascinating thing is that companies spend an average of $2,000 to $3,000 per worker to keep unions out.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It is amazing.
That is truly amazing.
Yep.
Now, I understand that China has just said to Walmart, you're going to have to unionize, which sounds like good news. The bad news is that in China, the union is the only official union.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a number of countries, but probably worse in that Sam Gompers, the founder of the American Federation of Labor, used to say here, a bad union is better than no union at all. I'm not sure that's the case in China, where it's an element of control by the central government.
Right.
No, I don't see this as an advantage in that particular country.
And yet Walmart is going to be able to say, well, you know, in fact, wait until you see the stickers on stuff in Walmart that says union made.
I'm not looking forward to it.
Do you think they'll do it?
only if they're focused focus groups on it'll work.
It wouldn't surprise me in the least.
It wouldn't surprise me. On the other hand, just next door to China, if I might add this, I understand we got a short show today. A few days ago, as they have every year, the union at Hyundai Motor concluded a strike, ending in a 5.1% increase in salary.
Good.
And those are free unions, so you see the difference between when you have them and when you don't have them.
There you go. Alec Dubrow, he's the media coordinator at the International Labor Communications Association, ILCAonline.org. Alec, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Wake up and shake it up, America.
From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea.
Our government gives a fight for we, the people who can't ignore
that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where we run rings around the right wing 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here on this program, right wherever you may be listening to us. In the chat room, you can get to the chat room by going to TomHartman.com. Sue put up some new little faces, icons, I guess they're called, or emoticons. And one is obviously Rama, and the other is me. I can see my own face in chat. How spooky is that? Mark Carlin is with us. He's the editor, the senior editor, and founder of BuzzFlash.com. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Tom.
Great to have you with us. All right, this is our best of the rest of the news segment, just looking over what's been going on over the last week here. It's Monday, and let's just kind of take an overview of the day. Bush and Congress show nearly record low ratings, while Democrats are viewed more favorably in the CBS New York Times poll. First of all, what's the news end of this, Mark? And then secondly, how do you think this is going to shake out in November, particularly given what Bobby Kennedy has told us about what the Republicans are capable of?
The Republicans under Karl Rove's tutelage have been excellent at pulling last-minute surprises, particularly using emotional issues to press the hot buttons of Americans. Just before elections, we saw the Osama tape come out just before the 2004 election, and most analysts now say that Osama was indeed probably trying to help Bush get elected. Plus, we do have, as Robert Kennedy and many, many others before him, and there's been a whole movement, as you know, including yourself, who have talked about the potential for election fraud with electronic voting machines and through a variety of other means, as we saw in Ohio, voter suppression. There's any number of ways. In Georgia, we have a law that's on hold right now, but possibly will go into effect, the Jim Crow law, which would require voter IDs and therefore reduce minority voting. And the Republicans are all about voter suppression and miscounting the vote to achieve victory. So anything can happen. I think these polls mislead the Democrats to believe that they can win by default, but I think they're going to have to win by playing an aggressive political game, which they really haven't shown yet that they're capable of.
Yeah, it really is the case that the Democrats are... I'm really torn about this, Mark. On the one hand, I really like the fact that the Democratic Party still values integrity, still values honesty, has a certain amount of naivete to it, still actually values democracy. That is to say that they don't just allow dissent within the Democratic Party, it's actually encouraged. Whereas the Republican Party is run increasingly like a kingdom, or something between a kingdom and a fascist state, with our leader at the top, and everybody has to march in lockstep. And yet at the same time, there's a very real political danger to the Democrats being democratic, small d democratic.
Well, I think that it is a classic conflict we've seen, particularly under the Bush administration, between authoritarianism with the paternal if you want to call it the daddy state, where you always believe the father is right, you don't question, and you just eat your peas and shut up, versus the family that sits down and has a conversation with an exchange of opinions. I mean, that's been the basic dynamic. But I would contend it's not just the Democrats have more integrity and therefore won't play the kind of dirty pool that the Republicans play. We historically have seen a lot of Democrats play dirty pool, particularly in machine politics, and we're from Chicago, and it's had a very nasty history of machine politics,
sure.
Much less so now. But the issue is really, can Democrats show that they have courage? If you look at Luis Obrador in Mexico, he showed he got out over 2 million people yesterday to protest the way that the elections were held there. We don't see the Democrats getting people out. We didn't see Al Gore in 2000 or John Kerry in 2004 to protest the way the Republicans were handling the vote from a variety of methods.
Right, or Busby in the last few months.
You see a candidate, Obrador, who is demanding what one should have in a democracy, which is in the full and complete recount. I think some people were misled into thinking there was a recount in Mexico. It was kind of what happened in Florida. What they did was they simply went over the tallies again, but they didn't recount every vote, and that's what Gore wanted in Florida. That's what Obrador wants in Mexico. Obrador fought for it. Al Gore didn't in 2000.
Well, actually, Al Gore did fight for it. George Bush sued him in the Supreme Court. The whole basis of the Bush v. Gore lawsuit was to stop the recount that the Supreme Court of the state of Florida had ordered at the request of Al Gore.
Well, I think
I mean, let's give Al Gore a little credit here, Mark.
He you're right, and I stand corrected. And I think the new Al Gore would lead an Obrador type of courageous outpouring to demand a vote. Let's put it this way: when the Supreme Court decision came down, I think Al Gore gave up too easily.
Well, yeah. At that point, it was either give in or rip the country apart, and that's in his mind. I wouldn't agree. I wouldn't make that statement. But
well, I think you have to. You don't have to become a sleazeball to beat the Republicans, but you have to have the courage to fight. And the Democrats give up too quickly because they perceive the Republicans are stronger than they are based on the Republicans making a perception that they're stronger. So
well,
it's a battle over perception.
Yeah, and then you've got folks like James Carville who are, these consultants who, by the way, is down in Mexico consulting with the conservatives. Suggesting, at least I believe so, suggesting that the Democrats should just become like the Republicans. And I remember talking with Professor Jack Forbes, a Native American professor of Native American studies at University of California, Davis, many years ago, back in 1986, when I was writing my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. And I devoted a chapter to this, in fact, in the book, about how Native Americans, when they were confronted with overwhelming forces, and principally technologically overwhelming, but also forces that they considered psychotic, people who were willing to engage in genocide, because most Native American communities and tribes, if they had warfare, it was very, very limited, and it never had the goal of wiping out another people and taking their land, because their land had the ghosts and the ancestors and everything. You just didn't want it. And he said, that the Europeans were infected with what they refer to as wetiko, which is a mental illness of cannibalism, essentially, eating the souls and spirits of others. But he said that the Native Americans were confronted with basically just a couple of very few choices. One was to run away, which is what, for example, the Shoshone did. They didn't even have a word for war in their vocabulary. They just ran away every chance they. But they lived in the desert in Nevada, so, I mean, there was always some place to run to. Number one, they could run away. Number two, they could get slaughtered, which many, many Native Americans did. They just, they took the Gandhi approach and they got slaughtered. Or number three, they could become their enemy and fight back, which a few tried. But the enemy was so, so powerful, they were overwhelmed. And he said, these are really horrible choices, to become insane like the enemy. And I'm really concerned about those who suggest that the Democrats should become like the Republicans.
I think the Democrats have to become leaders. I think they've lost the sense, quite literally, that you can lead Americans. They believe opinions and thoughts are fixed. They believe wedge issues are fixed. We're a country that's been evolutionary in nature and has constantly changed. And the Democrats somehow seem to think everything is frozen in place now, and they have to accept the Republican stance on this, that this is a conservative country. Actually, it's quite a progressive country when you get down to the issues.
Yes.
The battle has been over the perception of leadership, and the Republicans, for whatever their faults are, have the perception of leading. They may be leading us over a cliff, but they have the perception of leading. The Democrats don't seem to be leading us anywhere.
Yeah, good point. Mark, we've got about 2.5 minutes or so left here. The headline at BuzzFlash.com, we're talking with Mark Carlin, the founder and editor of BuzzFlash.com. The headline at BuzzFlash.com is one of your news analyses, which are always brilliant. This one is titled, Bush to Armageddon, Bring It On. Can you give us the one-minute summary of it?
Basically, there are two things that I think are very important that's happened within the last week. One, of course, is the Israeli war with Lebanon, Hezbollah in Lebanon, but basically Hezbollah and the nation of Lebanon, unfortunately. But that's actually been very fortuitous in a very suspicious way, because we no longer see any news about the war in Iraq, which has completely deteriorated to the point that Bush is putting extra troops into Baghdad. Bush, secondarily, some of these airstrikes that have killed civilians, we aren't saying this is the case, but suspiciously may be an attempt to draw Syria and Iran in the war and therefore give the U.S. justification to conduct airstrikes on both those countries.
I mean, you think that there are some out there who think that this may be provocation against the rest of the rest of the Muslim world. I was going to say Arab world, except the Iranians aren't Arabs,
well,
they're Persians.
There are those analysts and followers of the neocons who believe that Israel is being used as a proxy to try to draw Syria and Iran into the war. At the same time, on the Karov side, this is a good cover for what is basically Iraq on the brink of complete chaos. The second point is that in that analysis which you mentioned, Bring On Armageddon, Bush is a believer that somehow out of chaos comes calm. This is what God did when he created the earth. Bush is not God.
Yeah, well, that's, yes, indeed, and thank God for it. Mark Carlin, BuzzFlash.com, the website. Mark, always great talking with you.
Great talking with you, Tom. Thanks.
Thank you. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Where was the passion when you needed the most? Oh, you die. You pick up the leaves and the magic is lost. 'Cause you had a bad day, you didn't want it down.
Friends, 9.5 minutes before the hour here at the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least some democracy with a small d. You know, the real thing, actually, the will of the people kind of thing. People getting together, people caring for each other. We're all in this together. What a radical idea. What an absolute radical idea. Jeffrey Smith writing over in the Washington Post yesterday. Actually, it was on Friday. He said an obscure law approved a decade ago by Republican-controlled Congress has made the Bush administration nervous that officials and troops involved in handling detainee matters might be accused of committing war crimes and prosecuted at some point in U.S. courts. This is the War Crimes Act of 1996, and it criminalizes violations of the Geneva Convention. So now you've got some folks in the Bush administration, senior officials, who are drafting legislation that Republicans are going to be one of these days soon trying to shove through Congress in the middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning on a Friday. Just wait. That will say, the Geneva Convention, they don't apply to us. Supreme Court Washington Post notes, has, in contrast, repeatedly suggested U.S. courts should at least consider foreign interpretations of international treaties like the Geneva Conventions. Some human rights groups and independent experts say they oppose undermining the reach of the War Crimes Act, arguing that it deters government misconduct. Yes! If George W. Bush thinks he might be prosecuted as a war criminal, he's probably less and less likely to involve himself or us in war crimes. And wouldn't that be a nice thing? Meanwhile, Denmark. Denmark is the happiest place to live in the world. Yeah. In the world. This is a study of 80,000 people worldwide to map out subjective well-being. And what's interesting, the list, the top of the list is Denmark, and then Switzerland, and then Austria, and then Iceland, and then the Bahamas. Those are the top five. The number 178, Burundi. The U.S. is 23rd, which ain't bad. But the question is, what is it that causes, what are the constants? What are the things that are absolutely consistent? Reading from the BBC report on this. A nation's level of happiness was most closely associated with health levels, access to health care, particularly free access to health care. Prosperity and education were the next strongest determinants of national happiness. So when Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, if happiness is one of our national goals, how do you achieve that? National health care, free education all the way up through PhD, and prosperity by things like, gee, maybe a minimum wage and a strong unions. How about some radical idea like trade policies that actually protect the domestic industries and keep American jobs in America? Could be. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I just wanted to follow up on what Alec was talking about, the Chicago Living Wage Ordinance.
Yes, sir.
I represent America in Solidarity. I'm the education director.
Mm-hmm.
And we're committed to improving the lives of working families. And so for working people that make up our membership, a living wage ordinance is one of the best ways to ensure, like, you know, the bare minimum of compensation for jobs with these companies that come in and they're huge and they change the whole character of the community.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so why not, you know, force them to pay a decent wage?
Well, it's not even a matter of forcing them to pay a decent wage. It's saying, listen, you want to play the game of business? That's cool. You know, and
exactly.
we're giving you a lot of things. We're giving you some tax breaks here. And, we've got the police department that's keeping track of traffic for you so that people can get to your store. And we've got the fire department keeping you safe. And, I mean, we're providing you with a lot of services. All we ask is that you provide your employees with a decent wage. After all,
absolutely,
they're the people who live in the community who are paying the taxes that are supporting you.
Amen.
Amen.
Yeah. That's why we're moving to follow up on this victory with a nationwide living wage campaign. And so we're going to be putting up some information on our website soon. Thought I'd let everybody know.
And the website is?
It's www.americasolidarity.org.
Americasolidarity.org,
yeah. Okay. Talk about togetherness and getting involved. That's one way to do it.
Yeah, that's the bottom line. Okay.
And also about the union label in China, can I just talk about that for a second?
Sure.
I feel like a law has to be passed. Just, you know, the same way if you want fair trade or organic, you have to be regulated, you know, to make sure you are.
Yeah.
We should make sure that any company that has a union label, they're, 51% union. The union has to be totally democratic and not affiliated with the government. I mean, that'd be pretty easy, wouldn't it?
Well, you would think. Try getting that through the Republican Congress, though. I mean, this is a Republican Congress where, as you heard a little bit ago, the Republicans at 2:30 in the morning when they attach poison pills to things like the minimum wage increase, then brag about it, saying you Democrats are just upset because we outfoxed you.
And people wonder why unions support the Democrats.
Yeah. Gee, what a surprise. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening to us there on KPTK, Talk 1090 in Seattle. In fact, that's where I'll be broadcasting from live tomorrow out of Seattle. And tonight I'll be on stage with Bill Clinton and Jim McDermott. Should be great fun. Tomorrow I'll be debating conservative Andrew Coulson on the Republicans' push for national school vouchers.
And Alexander Steele is here for a Berlusconi alert in his new book, The Sack of Rome. That and more in your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program. And remember, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.